I'm so excited to share with you that the doors are officially open for my first ever phone-free event that's happening in Los Angeles, California on February 28th at Mudwater Gather in Santa Monica, with the option for you to dive even deeper on March 1st. Now look, this event is about you. It's about you building connections and community and us all really bringing this analog revolution to life and reminding our hearts and souls what we truly crave most, what nourishes our being, which is co-regulating with other humans, having our mirror neurons dance together, sharing experiences together, but also learning together. So on top of all the community and connection possibilities for you, there's also an incredible lineup of speakers. I've got internationally renowned nervous system expert Sarah Baldwin, Nike master trainer Brandon Collingsworth talking about purpose and meaning, and Mandy Balak, who's the president of the Gathering Festival, which is one of the largest marketing and branding conferences in North America. So we're going to be diving deeper into what does the future look like to walk alongside technology and use technology as a tool. Now look, if you want to dive even deeper, there's limited space for a VIP dinner on the Saturday night. And if you want to go even deeper, if it's aligned for leaders, coaches, therapists, entrepreneurs, branding, marketing, whoever is called, there's a mastermind on the Sunday morning with even more limited seating. And that's going to be about what does the future look like to create in this world with technology. So if this sounds like something you're interested in, you want to find out more and save your spot, go to markgroves.com/future. I can't wait to see you there.
You know, I've seen several thoracotomies now, which is when it's a last ditch effort. When they do an incision and they open up the rib cage and the physician places his hand inside and begins to do a cardiac massage on the heart. Can anything prepare you for seeing that? And this physician, I mean, he's reaching into the chest cavity like he's getting the last chip in a bag of potato chips. You know, this is kind of another day at work. Patient makes it or doesn't make it. I speak to these nurses and physicians because we offer staff care too. It gets to them too. No one can truly compartmentalize themselves to numb themselves to the things that they do. And these physicians and nurses, even if they don't feel it on this conscious level, at the heart and gut level, it's accumulating. When we read violent headlines, when we see the hurt in the world, that's all accumulating, you know. We're all carrying grief from something. The best that I can say is I'm very lucky to have a good and safe community that I'm not afraid to talk about these things with. And I think that's what we need, you know, safe landing to be able to talk about our grief and the things we accumulate.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the podcast. Today, I am so excited to be chatting with J.S. Park. He's the author of the recent book, As Long As You Need. And J.S., June, I'm so pumped that I get to have this conversation with you. I know that's paradoxical. It's like, I'm so excited to talk about grief, but I am. I think I've learned through my own experience and through learning from people like you that grief is actually a really magical place. It can be, not to minimize it, of course. So thanks for coming on the podcast and sharing your work.
Yeah, Mark, thank you for having me. And I got to say up front, I know that we rescheduled. You were so kind and caring to look out for my mental health. I had a thing going on that week. So I appreciate your graciousness, stretching yourself and inviting me into your space. So I'm thankful for you and I'm glad to be here.
Well, of course. And, you know, I think what's interesting about your experience of why you needed to reschedule is just like how much you're in the humanness of it, you know, that you're not like often I'll say a pope on a pulpit, you know, expressing that, but you're actually like in the weeds with people.
Yeah. My job isn't just a job and I'm not able to leave work at work. And, you know, the distance that is sometimes required for certain roles and functions and jobs that we have, I'm asked to close the distance completely. That's what my role requires of me. So when you say in the humanness of it, that's absolutely right. You know, there is no arm's length that I can keep in the role that I'm in. And so, yeah, mental health and all of it, it all affects me. You know, I remember all of my patients and it all accumulates and some weeks it can be too much. There are times when you ever have that thing where you cancel something or somebody cancels on you and you're just like, oh, thank God. I get that feeling a lot.
I bet. And for context, for those of you listening or watching, JS works at a hospital. Like, is it the number one trauma?
Yeah, it's a level one trauma center. I think we're, it's 1,000+ beds. Wow. Yeah. And we get traumas around the clock. I think we're like the number one hospital in Tampa Bay and maybe number four in the state of Florida. But it is, yeah, it's next level cutting edge. It's a great hospital that I work at. And also, as you can imagine, we get some of the hardest cases. So yeah, it's constant nonstop. It's working there is like being inside of a small city. It's a microcosm of the world, really.
And how is, because I'm always curious from the perspective of a chaplain, how does that integrate into the care for trauma and for loss? And like, what is the role and when does it start?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mark. I'm very thankful at our hospital, the one I work at, we're very deeply integrated into the care team. The nurses and physicians, they know exactly when to call for us and send us a consult. Yeah, so we attend every single death, every single code blue, every trauma that comes in the emergency department. Yeah, and we help with end-of-life care, advanced care planning. And then if a patient needs spiritual support, emotional support, somebody just to listen, we're there for all of those, crisis assistance, somebody who needs prayer, somebody who needs a Bible, somebody who needs a chat for 45 minutes. We're there for all of those things. And so I've sometimes gotten calls ranging from a nurse saying, you know, somebody's yelling on the sixth floor. can you get over
here?
Send the Lord. Yeah. So, you know, we might go there to de-escalate or figure out what's going on, find the need of this patient, enter into the situation. And, you know, chaplain has the baggage of being a religious term, but I don't bring up religion, you know, unless the patient does. I enter in very arms, you know, open to anything, any worldview this patient has. So I'll see anybody. We see anyone. We're interfaith chaplains. We're ecumenical. We work across the aisle with anybody. And even among the chaplains, we're not all just Christians. So we cover a wide range of activities. Some of the stuff that we do overlaps with social work. Like we also do next of kin searches. If someone can't have their identity established and family found, we'll also help with that. We do advanced directives, which is, you know, if someone wants a designated decision maker in the case that they couldn't make decisions, we assist with that. And that's a heavy decision to make.
Yeah.
Because it's basically saying, you know, if I'm unconscious in a procedure and I need consent for something, I trust this person to make those decisions for me. And then living will is expression of wishes about if they ever end up on life support, what they would want. And chaplains will walk through that step by step. So I've heard of hospitals where chaplains do very basic things like, you know, the spiritual and emotional support is really important. And sometimes I wish that's all I had to focus on. But we cover such an extensive wide range of duties. And honestly, I love every part of it because it's holistic care. We're meeting many different needs of the patient. We do all the in-between stuff. You know, I think I say something in my book like between the medicine and the machines, you know. We're there for the human part of it. And even with things like the end of life planning and all of that, those technical decisions like here's my healthcare surrogate or here's what my living will states, those things need support around that conversation. So if you had like a paralegal come in and do that, it might not be the same as sending a chaplain to do it. The technical definition, I think, for a chaplain is non-anxious, non-judgmental, comforting presence.
Non-anxious, non-judgmental. I like that.
Yeah.
So you will not bring anxiety into this space.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe anti-anxious or yeah.
How do you prepare yourself, you know, to be in that space, to be that reference point of peace, I guess, or the gateway to walking that pathway to death? Like that's, people don't explore that their whole lives. And then here they are in that moment where, you know, you're holding space for the existential crisis.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you like a non-answer and then a in-between answer, I guess. I mean, the non-answer is like, can anyone really be prepared for something like that? I think of our first responders, physicians and nurses, especially those who work in the emergency department, they're in the fray and in this very tense, almost war zone like situation of just seeing one patient after another on the worst day of their lives. So humanly speaking, it's incredibly difficult to be able to prepare ourselves for what we're going to see. Because I think I've seen it all, and then I'll see one more, you know. But one thing I can say is I'm very, very lucky to work among other chaplains, to work alongside other chaplains who we have the same page, the same goal, the same mission, and we have this camaraderie. One of the guys I work with, and I work with him every shift, we have our chemistry so on lock that we can just kind of communicate just looking at each other. You know, if you've ever played on a band, you know, when the guitarist looks at the drummer, they don't have to say much. They just kind of give each other a look. They know exactly when to start and when to end, you know, when the beat drops and when to, you know, pull back. It's that sort of kind of chemistry, you know, musician or military-like, I guess. So I'm very glad that I have these other chaplains that I can process with, and that, you know, if something becomes too much, they can pick up the slack. And it's sort of that idea of like, you know, one stick by itself can be broken easily, but, you know, a whole band of sticks together cannot. You know, we got each other's back. And so I think knowing that makes the biggest difference. And that's true in any community. That's true in the household. That's true in the church. That's true at a workplace. So we are allowed in between visits to process with each other. You know, the running joke is chaplains make the best chaplains. So, yeah, so we're lucky that we got each other. But I have little rituals too, you know. I mean, I'm lucky that I have a very long drive to work, about an hour there, hour back home. And so that gives me a lot of buffer and space to kind of mentally and emotionally prepare. It's almost like I'm transitioning from here's my home. And then now I'm transitioning into this space of, you know, high acuity patients and trauma and all of that. And then on the way home, I get to decompress an hour back. And then in between patient visits, you know, I think we're talking about this before we start recording, but I do journal between patient visits, even if I just write down one sentence. Because for one, it helps me to honor the patient and the room that I was just in. And two, I think it helps for me, whatever I'm holding, to kind of put it on the page and to process it myself, you know. But yeah, going back to that beginning thing, though, the first thing that I had mentioned was that how can we prepare for something like that? You know, because I'm thinking of the depth of the stuff I've seen. You know, I've seen several thoracotomies now, which is when it's a last ditch effort. When they do an incision and they open up the rib cage and the physician places his hand inside and begins to do a cardiac massage on the heart.
Woof.
And, you know, can anything prepare you for seeing that? You know, and this physician, I mean, he's reaching in to the chest cavity like he's getting the last chip, you know, in a bag of potato chips. You know, this is kind of another day at work. But, you know, after that happens, patient makes it or doesn't make it. I speak to these nurses and physicians because we offer staff care too. It gets to them too. You know, no one can truly compartmentalize themselves to numb themselves to the things that they do. And these physicians and nurses, even if they don't feel it on this conscious level, at the heart and gut level, it's accumulating. And, you know, even when we read violent headlines, when we see the hurt in the world, that's all accumulating. You know, we're all carrying grief from something. And so the best that I can say is I'm very lucky to have a good and safe community that I'm not afraid to talk about these things with. And I think that's what we need. You know, safe landing to be able to talk about our grief and the things we accumulate.
How do you define grief?
So clinical definition would be grief is our natural response to loss. So when we lose a person or lose a dream or lose our mental health or lose our autonomy, when we experience sudden deficit of something that was comfortable, familiar, or that we loved, our body is going to respond. And that response, very classically, we see it as sorrow and sadness, but it can be a wide range of responses. And so what emerges from loss can be weeping, but it can also be extreme rage. It can be numbness and shutting down. It can be fatigue. I've seen laughing and singing and dancing and clapping and rolling on the floor. So grief, you could say, is this natural and even automatic response to loss. But grief also contains a conscious and intentional choice that we can make as well. And I think that's something that not as many of us are familiar with or have learned, to have grief literacy and to understand grief as a language that we can speak and become fluent in. And so here you have the emergent response of grief when you first find out that loss has occurred or as the loss is occurring. And then you have the intentional choice that you can make. So in my own writing and in my own practice, I try to differentiate, even if I don't say it out loud in that way. You know, however you respond, however long it takes, the timeline that you need, all of that's okay. And I try to make as wide a space as I can for any sort of grief response, whether that's rage or shutting down. But then you have on this side also the validating and the ritualizing and commemorating and the honoring of that grief. And in that, people can make intentional and conscious choices of honoring those losses. And that is a kind of grieving as well. You can say grieving ing, like using that as an ongoing practice. And so, chaplains, we often sit in that first space, the grief that emerges. Then the intentional conscious grief is something that we can transition to or move towards or offer as almost like a takeaway or something practical and tangible. So to answer your question, Mark, I think grief is our response to loss, whether that's something that emerges or that's something that we can choose to do, and we need both.
How has your experience pre being a chaplain compared, like how has it changed as a chaplain versus like a guy, you know, in the world?
Yeah. You know, so it's probably, you know, a common story that I have in that, you know, we've been taught, maybe even indoctrinated, to believe that grief is something harmful and something we need to get past, get over, you know, and just move through, let it go and move forward and all of that. And so my impulse was to fix or to quickly bow tie and, you know, smooth it over with positivity and the pep talk our way out of grief. And so I think before I got to the hospital, you know, almost 9 years ago now, I had an idea that, you know, the grief that I would see, it would be sad, sure, it would be solemn and very somber, but I could help transition people to reintegrate back into positivity or livelihood or to get back to function, you know? I think that was my very idealistic, romanticized picture of grief. And we even had this book that we've since stopped using. It's like a really short little picture book that showed grief as, here you're walking in this grassy field and then you hit a valley, you know, and valley is the loss. And you climb back up to the summit where there's flowers on top. And it was this very linear picture of what grief looks like. And I think most of us have that sort of picture of what grief looks like in our heads. And that's what I, as a kind of young idealistic chaplain, that's how I first started. Until I realized that grief is nonlinear. And it is, you know, I think it might be finance or it might be, there's some sort of principle, maybe physics, where, you know, you have your normal landscape. It's the predictable landscape, and it can have twists and turns, but it's pretty predictable. And then you have your changing landscape, which is like very rough terrain. And then you have your dynamic landscape, which is every step you take, everything changes. And so the dynamic landscape is completely unpredictable and chaotic and doesn't necessarily follow any sort of linear or correlational principle. And that's often how grief is. There's no consistency. And so I learned very quickly, I came in with these big ideas about I'm going to help and heal people. But grief is one of those things that very often remains in the unresolved and the unfixable, because the loss itself is very often unreturnable and irretrievable. A chasm opens up in the ground and you lose the people or the dreams or the things that you love and you can't get them back. And it's like this great curtain folds over it. And the stitch is airtight. And you can't get that back from the void where it goes. And what I've learned is that's not a thing that can be fixed with a magical combination of words. But as a chaplain, what I can do is sit alongside and sit in the hurt and recognize that our response of anger, our response of sorrow, deep anguish and agony, all of that is okay. It's even right. And I can't fix it, but I can sit alongside of it. And we don't move forward or get over it or get past it. But we carry that grief with us, and we learn in some way to manage what life looks like with this huge hole in the middle of it. And so I would say, I came in with wide eyes thinking I could fix or solve or heal. But just like every patient who enters the hospital from the front, I left through the side, you know? And I realize now grief isn't linear. It isn't just, you know, front door, back door. It's front door and then all through the halls and up and down and all around through the side. So I would say there's a hardness in that, but there's also kind of a blessing in that, where letting go of those expectations, helping to really be present with people.
That seems to run counterculture to the idea of letting go, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you know what, Mark, I think letting go makes sense as an idea in the short term, because grief is so painful. I completely empathize with people who say, you know, we need to let go, keep the past in the past, don't go negative. You know, because I used to get enraged when like a pastor or, you know, a family member would come in and they'd start saying things like, you know, you got to be strong, don't cry, you know, this is God's will, everything happens for a reason. And, you know, all of that stuff, you know, this is, this, you can learn something
bumper
from this.
Stickers.
Yeah. You know, don't ask for a lighter load, get a stronger spine and all this stuff, you know.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Very sugary, like one-liners. I used to get enraged at that. And part of me still gets really, really mad at that. But what I understand is that loss is so terrifying that people need branches on the way down to grasp. And so sometimes the only things that they were taught were these one-liners or this kind of theological scaffolding that's not going to hold up in the deepest pit, but it's all they got. And when we see someone hurting, that impulse to want to fix is a compassionate impulse. It's positive intent. And so I've over the years gained more empathy for people who say those kind of things, recognizing that they may not have the capacity or the tool set to embrace the loss and look it in the face as it is. I mean, when mortality creeps through the window and we're faced with the abyss, it induces panic. You know, it induces terror. I mean, just to think that you go or I got to watch you go, or you got to watch me go, that's a bad deal. I mean, that's awful. When I look at my spouse, I mean, my greatest fear, the nightmares that I have are to find my spouse dead. And, you know, since starting this job, you know, I have dreams about my patients all the time, but I'll sometimes wake up 3 or 4 in the morning in a sweat and in a panic and lean over and check if my wife is breathing, because that's just my fear. And one day that fear will be realized, whether she sees me go first or I see her go first. And, you know, knowing that, I hold a lot of compassion for people who use these statements to almost whistle past the graveyard. And, I empathize with that. So it makes sense to me why the philosophy of letting go came to be, because we're scared, because we're afraid. But what I've come to learn is that when people feel lost, here's this pain. And then there's an additional burden that we end up placing on each other when we say, let go, get past it, move beyond it. That's a second pain that we put on, a pressure for people.
That's interesting. Yeah. That's a suffering that we create.
That's exactly right. As if grief is like a walk that can be, like a marathon that can be finished, you know, or a problem that can be solved.
Right. You're just not done yet.
Yeah. Like the end goal is you're going to be over it and you're going to wake up one morning and you won't even feel it at all, you know? That's an additional pressure that we put on people. I think it's something I read, Barbara Ehrenreich, she wrote a book called Brightsided. And she talked about the thing that was almost as bad as her cancer was people telling her how her cancer was a gift, or it's something that she could fight, you know, or just stay positive and you'll be okay. It was this additional pain that was placed on her. And it's something culturally that we burden ourselves with, thinking that it's going to help, and it may in the short term. But in the long term, it's denial and avoidance. And, you know, every study has shown, and human nature has shown, if you suppress something, it only makes it worse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It gets buried, rerouted, and becomes stronger, and not always in the ways that we want it to be. You know, it might manifest in experiences of illness ourselves, or experiences of reactivity and destruction and addiction. And, you know, it's like, the one thing I learned about navigating grief sober was that it demands to be felt. Like, it's not an optional, like, I'm just going to exit stage, you know, stage left here. There is a confrontation that it's almost like a tumbleweed blowing across, you know, a high noon showdown. But, you know, it's, as you said, for you and I to face the idea that we'll lose one another and it's inevitable is not culturally something that we are asked to walk towards. Because if I acutely get walked towards it through illness or a trauma, I now have not been prepared for the exploration. And it's so beautiful that where you work, you are that almost like trauma response team that's like, hey, we're actually going to prepare you really quickly for the things you might have to confront and navigate. And I'm curious, when you talk about grief, where is the sacred tension between its biological process, right? That you're saying people dance, they sing, there's some sort of thing that's being asked to be alchemized, I guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what is a spiritual aspect of it, or a divinity to it? Is there a divinity to it?
Yeah. What a great question, Mark. You know, I am very careful about when I'm with my patients to name the spiritual unless that they want to.
Mm-hmm.
And when we start to spiritualize anything, that can come with a lot of strings attached, because there is so much theology that is imparted that is unsafe and unhealthy. And so I try to be careful with correlational things. So for an example, if I just pray hard enough, my loved one will make it through this code blue, the resuscitational work. You know, what if it doesn't? You know, if I'm a good person, if I read the Bible enough or things like that. So spiritualizing certainly has its downside in that we can start to attach value judgments, correlation, the idea that God is answering prayer, but then if God doesn't, what does that mean for us? The idea that at the center of the universe, there is a benevolent good that must answer, but if they don't, does that mean that the universe is callous and cruel or neglectful and abusive? But to answer that question, and I hope I'm answering the question, Mark.
That was beautiful. I love the string of thought.
Yeah, yeah. You know, there are times when, I can say it two ways. There are times when a patient or their family does something that they don't name it as spiritual, but I see it absolutely as something spiritual and beautiful. So I'll see in a room where someone has just died, and I may ask the family, they may ask me to do some sort of prayer of blessing, or they may ask me to offer comfort or counsel, or what are the next steps? And I'll often ask the question, may I ask, what was this person like? And one by one, they'll start sharing stories. You know, it may start with just adjectives turn to verbs, and they just start sharing stories. And I'll see around this body, laughter bursting out from family because of the stories being shared. And Mark, that is a spiritual experience. They're not naming God. They're not talking about, you know, anything theological. But the community and the communion that they're sharing, not just the breaking of bread, but the breaking of stories. I mean, that is a beautiful spiritual thing. And then there are other people who, they want the spiritual because it gives them a hope to be able to manage and hold this situation, to hold this terrible loss. So I'll give you an example. I have baptized a lot of infants who have died. That's a heavy thing to even say out loud. These babies who are, you know, 2-3 pounds. And the families that ask for some kind of blessing or baptism, a lot of them are not religious. They just want any kind of ritual to be able to honor their child who has died and to get them through this terrible loss. And so, you know, I'll ask permission every step of the way. Would you like me to read a section of scripture? Would you like me to do a prayer? Was your tradition in your family Catholic? I can do something in that, you know, with a Catholic prayer, a Catholic ritual, you know, or maybe Buddhist, or maybe, you know, I'll customize it to what this family wants. In this family that's not religious, they still want something to hold on to that they feel is bigger than their understanding, to make sense of it all, to kind of give it up to this greater divinity, to say, we don't understand, but we need to feel that there is, that the universe still loves us, or that God is somehow still in the room,
that there's, or that this,
or that this baby's soul is safe, you know? We need to feel that this wasn't for nothing. And so in that sense, they're tapping into divinity and into spirituality. And, you know, it may be just that one time in the room, and after that, that's it. And that's what they need. And that's what I'm there for. So I know that there are a lot of theological arguments about should babies be baptized, et cetera, but, you know, I almost don't care about those arguments. A lot of the doctrinal, theological, the stuff Christians argue about, I'm just so far removed from it now. Well, for me, it's, what does this family need to tap into something bigger than themselves that they can find comfort and hope in?
Well, it's almost like the theological part is disconnected from the human, you know, in the actual, in that moment, who gives a shit about the
absolutely
the theological, you know? And, you know, it's so, when I see people maybe turn who were formerly anti-religion and then become vehemently religious, usually through unexpected loss, like when I've witnessed that, or like I can think of like growing up, how I had a friend's mother, they lost his father, and they went from like not religious at all to extremely religious. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand it as a kid. I just remember all of a sudden this mom that I was around a lot all of a sudden started to like ram theology down my throat. And not through consent, just through opportunity. But I didn't understand that. And I understand it in hindsight, that when the world delivers you unexpected things, how do you cope with that from a mental health perspective? How do you, and sometimes the only thing that we can cling to is that there is something greater. And I often think, I mean, I got shivers as you were telling the stories, because I don't know why I got them, but the sense I got was that it's like we can either believe that all of this is just, we're a bunch of biological beings on a planet and we're no different than an amoeba and there's nothing spiritual about this and it's just science. And I can understand, as you were saying, the failure of theology. And I want to dive a little deeper into that, that when you're in suffering, the idea that the construct of the maybe the religious framework you have no longer makes sense. But that's true also of the scientific framework, when it's easy to just disconnect and say we're biological beings who live and then we die and we suffer from different ailments and here's the pathology of these things. But then you're left with this strange paradox that you are a personality, a soul, a prefrontal cortex, a brain. Like there's, like my body is aging. I'm 45 now. Mm-hmm. But my brain doesn't, like I feel, you know, that my, you know, for example, like a ligament in my toe is not quite as functional as it used to be. But I don't, you know, my soul feels more functional, maybe more liberated. So it's interesting that as I age, I feel like developmentally I'm getting more soul expressed, but physically I'm getting more constrained. So I'm curious, I know that was a long diatribe, but I'm curious what that brings up for you and that tension that you see within the atheist, you know, that you were talking about, this family that's like, I need something, but also the failure for the Christian that this doesn't make sense anymore.
Yeah, you know, I grew up atheist and I became, I guess, a Christian late in life. And then the church the American church quickly kind of lost any kind of sense or meaning for me. And got into chaplaincy. I tried in the church for like 7 years, but realized quickly, I guess not quickly, 7 years is quite a while, but I realized, you know, I don't think I could get the work done that I wanted to. But in chaplaincy, I lost my faith during my residency because of all the suffering that I was seeing. And I wrote about that in my book in chapter 2.
Yeah.
If there are any two chapters for anyone who wants to read, chapter 2, loss of faith, and chapter 8, the loss of loved one, I would recommend at least those two, if I may indulge myself in doing that. But
you may.
Yeah, because it is one of those things where, for one, what it brings up for me is when people lose their faith due to things they experience in the church or religious trauma, spiritual abuse, I mean, all of that 100% makes sense to me. And I had those kind of hurts too. And if someone loses their faith over seeing the amount of suffering that they've seen, or if they have suffered in their own life, that also 100% makes sense to me as well. And then you also mentioned people who, you know, they went from completely not religious to extremely religious, maybe because of a traumatic event that they faced. And my thing is I try not to really persuade anyone into something else. You know, for me, it's if this comfort, if this hope works for this person, you know, if they're not harming themselves and harming other people, then I'm for it. So, you know, I went to visit this patient, I remember, where they and their family, as soon as I walked in, they were watching this preacher on their phone. And I recognized this preacher on the phone because he was one of those prosperity theology type preachers that I knew, oh man, he's just, you know, bamboozling the congregation out of money. He's probably got a private jet and, you know, the whole red carpet up to the pulpit and all of that. And they were watching this preacher on their phone, and they were laughing together and even high-fiving each other. And they were really into it. The patient that I went to see, he had a terminal illness. And when I went into the room, they saw my badge was a chaplain. I was there to offer support. And they kind of looked at me and they said, we got a theological question for you, which doesn't always happen, actually. Hmm. I'm usually there to listen. But sometimes when someone directly asks me for advice, or they want a real answer, I'm like, oh, man, you know, they want my actual opinion. And I almost want to, like, do the therapist thing and bring it back to them. Be like, well, how do you feel about that? Yeah. But they... You know, or, you know, the therapist answer when you don't want to judge someone, the therapist, you know, after hearing a crazy story, they'll say, oh, that's interesting. That's the neutral response that therapists are taught. So I, you know, they ask me, you know, hey, we got a theological question. What do you think about this preacher? We're told that he's this false preacher and he's just wants people's money and he's like the prosperity, whatever. And what I wanted to tell them was, yeah, this guy, you know, et cetera, you know, all of that is true. But this family was so happy watching this preacher that I couldn't bring myself. I couldn't stomach the idea of just kind of bursting their bubble. Mm. And I basically said, hey, if it works for you, it works for you. I think that's great, you know? And then I ended up watching this preacher with them for like the next 20 minutes, kind of hanging out with them a little bit. And you know what? It was a good sermon. it was kind of fluffy, but very inspirational. So I kind of want to make room for all of it. And I'm not saying all of it is okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've seen how when you talked about, like, here's this side of how maybe science doesn't accommodate. And then here is, it's easy to see why people may cling to religion. You know, I think with my atheist friends, I 100% want to understand and be there. I mean, I was there, you know. And for religion, there are still parts of it that I am very wary about and cautious about and skeptical about, but also want to completely understand, like, how it works mm-hmm. for them. And it reminds me, I just pulled up this, have you heard of a book called When Breath Becomes Air?
No.
It's written by the late Dr. Paul Kalanithi. He was a neurosurgeon resident, and he died of cancer. And he sort of speed wrote this book. about his residency experience. And very scientific, very, very emotional, really well done book. But he, at the end, sort of comes out and says why he chose Christianity as his faith. And it's quite a surprising turn. You know, it's quite a surprising, like, at the very end, after all this kind of talk about his surgery and, you know, how precise he did, like, he just came to the conclusion as he was dying that the Christian God was for him. And he wrote this, and if you don't mind, I'll read just a quick portion of it.
Please.
Yeah, it says, yet the paradox is that scientific methodology is a product of human hands and thus cannot reach some permanent truth. We build scientific theories to organize and manipulate the world to reduce phenomena into manageable units. Science is based on reproducibility and manufactured objectivity. As strong as that makes its ability to generate claims about matter and energy, it also makes scientific knowledge inapplicable to the existential, visceral nature of human life, which is unique and subjective and unpredictable. Science may provide the most useful way to organize empirical, reproducible data, but its power to do so is predicated on its inability to grasp the most central aspects of human life: hope, fear, love, hate, beauty, envy, honor, weakness, striving, suffering, virtue. Between these core passions and scientific theory, there will always be a gap. No system of thought can contain the fullness of human experience. Mm. The realm of metaphysics remains the province of revelation. And he goes on like that. And, you know, if you go on the Amazon reviews, which I try to avoid, but, you know, I was like, I got to see what they say about this. There are quite a lot of one-star reviews about this passage. To be fair, I can see why it would bother them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not saying I 100% agree, or, you know, there are parts of that where I'm like, well, maybe that's what they call, you know, God between the gaps, like a cop-out answer, you know. But I just love that. I thought it was pretty balanced. And I do think there is room for mystery and ambiguity. And there are days that I really struggle in my faith. And there are days that, you know, I've lost my faith several times since that first time in residency. And what it comes down to is it harder to believe, or is it harder not to? Hmm. You know, is it harder?
That's an interesting question, because it's that dancing in the sacred tension, which isn't that it, like, in general, is our ability to be between these worlds, you know, as, you know, Christ said, to be in the world, but not of the world. You know, you're like in both. You're in the 3D, you're a biological being with a nervous system who falls in love, who then experiences loss, which is inevitable. And I don't know, because as someone who grew up Catholic, but then definitely resisted any of that, because I found that church was really weaponized against me. That was my experience of going to a Catholic school. And just that there was all these things that the church preached, and then there were all these things the church did. And that's why I really love the way you express, because you hold the reality of the abuse, of the inconsistencies, of where, like, we can't just pretend it doesn't exist. That's just another toxic human system. That's where we all have to not talk about the elephant in the room. But
yeah,
that's where religion gets co-opted by humans, who then bring in the shadow manipulative aspect, which is trying to curate morality, and maybe not even just morality, but weaponize the idea of God or a greater being to influence human behavior in a way that is best for whoever that person is, or whatever entity. And I think the way you navigate it is the reality, like, even in the belief in science, there is going to be a crisis of belief, because you're going to see things like thalidomide that hurt people and harm people. You'll see a lot of the stuff recently, the manipulation and influence of data, et cetera. And it's like Jonathan Haidt, you know, Jonathan Haidt.
Mm-hmm.
I love how he's an atheist, and he talks about how every human has a God-sized hole within them. And so his belief in the value of God comes from, like, human evolution need. But he speaks at Christian places because they both believe in the need for God. There's just a different role. And when I think about the exploration of grief, I just love that the way that you as a chaplain, but the way that it sounds like all the chaplains do, is they meet people where they're at and provide the gateway that the person needs. And so how do, like, what do you recommend to somebody? What advice do you have for when they are in the company of someone who's grieving a loss or, you know, and you talked about all the different types of grief, but what would it look like to actually hold space and be the chaplain, you know, on some level?
Yeah. Well, I can give you kind of a two-part answer to that. I would say on that first level, you know, the people that we love, the people that we are closest to who experience loss, I hope that we know the people that we love. And so we would know, hopefully, also what they need and to be attuned to their needs. And there is something in us that sometimes when we are within the vicinity of someone who is hurting or when they're celebrating, we may switch and start to center ourselves a little bit, whether by trying to top their story or share something similar or something like that. We don't always do it intentionally, but we sometimes turn the spotlight on ourselves. When someone is grieving, that's like the worst thing you can do, you know. As they pour out to you, then you just dump back to them, you know. Oh, that reminds me of a time. We don't want to story top or make it about ourselves. We want to be able to attune ourselves to them. And doing that requires a very intentional and purposeful sensitivity and care. And then not just to say general vague things like, well, how are you doing? Or let me know if you need anything, you know? But we know the people that we love to really think through as if we're writing like a textbook or a thesis on them. Like, what are the things that they like? What are the things that would help them right now? And to be very specific and to say, look, Tuesday and Thursday, I know that you get off work at this time. I'd like to bring, do you want barbecue or do you want, you know, sushi? I'll bring those by. If you want to talk, you can talk, or I can just drop it off at your door. To be that specific. And so I would say, one, to center that person who is in loss as much as we can. So not just throw a general casserole. I have nothing against casseroles.
Yeah.
But, you know, that sometimes, you know, we just do that and then go. But we know the people that we love. Will they like to be taken out to go get a hamburger or to go see a movie? Do they want to be left alone and just be sent a text saying, I'm available and here if you want to talk tonight? I remember one time I was grieving and I texted a friend saying, I want to call you, but I don't want you to come over because I don't have the capacity for someone to be here and for me to, you know, be a host. And I don't want to go over there, but can you just stay on the phone and maybe like every 10 seconds, just breathe really loud so I know you're there, you know? I don't want to be alone. I just want you to stay on the phone with me. They were able to do that for like an hour, you know, while I was going about my day. So we know the people we love. We know the things that they need. And so how can we center them the best that we can? And then I think the other thing is, you know, earlier I alluded to, there's no magical thing we can say. You know, there's no perfect combination of words. I think to be there for someone is as simple and as hard as it sounds, you know, just to be there. And sometimes people will ask me, like, as a chaplain, like, what do you do? You know, do you just go around and hang out with people and just pray for them? And I'm like, sometimes, but it's a lot harder than you would think, mm-hmm. you know, just to really truly be there for someone. And earlier I said the non-anxious, non-judgmental presence. Sometimes being with someone as they're venting, as they're sharing how hard it's been, as they're going through all their rage or their weeping, crying at the top of their lungs, crying in a way that's not Hollywood at all, but can even be awkward and messy and slobbery and uncomfortable. There is a way that we can be that is anxiety inducing and judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a way that we can be where even just raising the eyebrows or breaking eye contact when we shouldn't or checking our phone when we shouldn't. Those kinds of things are distracted and they create anxiety rather than alleviating it. And so being there does take a lot of presentness, and that's not easy. And again, that goes back to the umbrella of completely centering that person. So I would say at least two things: attuning ourselves to that person and what they need to center them completely, and two, being as present and available as possible when we're in the presence of that person. And those things are not as easy as they sound, but also everyone can do them. It is possible. And so sometimes I will just ask, you know, how are you holding up? And if they talk for 10 seconds, or if they vent for 45 minutes, I'm there and I'm completely present. And I don't lecture, I don't push back, I don't evaluate, I don't judge. And I try not to even make too much motion. And so, Mark, if you ever get to shadow me and you see me in a room, I'm like more still than the curtain. You know, I just don't move. I'm locked in, you know.
And black belt training has served you.
It's the discipline, yeah. And you know, it's almost this meditative flow state. And then when I do get to talk, I will reference things that they've said and try to bring it back. And I guess at least it shows them that I'm listening, you know, and it's not a trick. It's not something that you can just do as if like, you know, this is my therapeutic thing that I'm pulling, you know, a magic trick. It's I'm really there and I really care. So yeah, for those who are dealing with somebody who's in loss, try not to make it about yourself, you know, because that temptation will come up. And then also be present and available in a non-judgmental way where you allow that person to vent and do what they need to do, and that they would feel safe with you when they do that.
How does that impact you, that you hold so much space for everybody else, that when it's time for JS to be held, or like, how does it impact your ability to be held, to receive, to take up space, since you are like such a sacred space for people you don't even know, right? And that you become obviously very close with very quickly. But how does that impact you and your home and all that, if you're open to
sharing? Yeah. Yeah. You know, this will be the most that I talk all week, Mark, because most of my job is listening and being still and present. Yeah. But, you know, I can't leave my work at work. I do take it with me.
Yeah.
It does affect me a lot. You know, my friend, Chaplain Larry, and my friend and coworker, he says grief takes up so much space. And it's true. And I think I've made peace, some kind of tense peace, with the idea that this will be my role. And it's hard. It's not easy. I mean, I've had peptic ulcers now twice in the last 9 years.
Wow.
I've collapsed twice at work. And I could blame myself, but I know some of that had to do with just what I was experiencing. You know, vicarious trauma, secondhand grief, all that cumulative, taking that in, it can change the body. You know, it literally chemically changes you. And so that's true of healthcare workers or first responders. You know, it does change us. So I wish I had some easy answer to tell you, Mark. I mean, sometimes I do just fall apart and I let myself weep. You know, even my mental health this last month has really taken a hit. And there are times, even physiologically, like there are times I can't stop weeping, you know, for hours. Like I'll just be doing something regular, like, you know, maybe I'm doing my laundry or I'm at the gym or something. And literally my body is holding it, but my body, the body doesn't lie, you know?
Right.
And I'm just involuntarily weeping, remembering my patients. Wow. And so, yeah, I've made this kind of almost tense truce or peace with the idea that this is not something I'll ever get used to. And I guess maybe the day that I get used to it is the day I need to quit. That's the irony of it, you know?
Yeah. It's almost like detachment means a disassociation on some level.
Right. I mean, the thing that keeps me open and a chaplain is what makes me human. And what makes me human is what makes me a chaplain, you know? Yeah. I have a thin skin and I own that. So yeah, it's tough. But, you know, I had mentioned earlier about having good and safe community, about being able to process with chaplains. I do see a therapist and my therapist is awesome. And I couldn't do that, you know, do the work without her. And so we all need these kind of, it's not just self-care. You know, I think when we talk about self-care, it's almost like I'm going to recharge and then get back to the real life, you know? Like me being with my kids, me seeing a therapist, me processing with fellow chaplains, me having a lunchtime with friends, which I schedule every month, you know, me doing an interview like this, this is not just self-care. This is not just like, oh, here's this thing that I'm going to do, recharge, and then go back to work. This is all a part of life. It's all together. You know, me being with my kids is not my self-care. That's me living my life. And I would say that's important, that the work that I do at the hospital is not the only thing that I do. Work is not the only thing in my life. And that for me is what is makes a fulfilling life. And so allowing myself to experience everything that I do, not just the hard stuff, but the joyful stuff, you know? And so I think it is really important for me to see the stuff like if I exercise or I eat right or I'm journaling, that that's all a part of life. It's mm-hmm. not just something that I'm doing to go back into the fray. Mm-hmm. And that kind of recontextualizing, at least for me, helps me to see it as this kind of larger picture, and keeps me from, I think, taking in the trauma in a way that would be overwhelming or too painful, you know?
It's almost like, to be a chaplain or a death doula or someone who is in that space, it requires like also spending once a month in a room with puppies, you know, like the miracle of life, which without death is not a miracle, you know, on some level.
And yeah.
I remember hearing Alan Watts say that we often think about what will it be like to go to sleep and never wake up. But we don't think about what was it like to wake up having never gone to sleep. And I don't know, there's years ago, I wrote about this experience just of recognizing that to love anything or anyone is always held with the paradox of its loss. So your ability to hold loss will always dictate your ability to love, because those are being held in the same moment always. And mm-hmm. when I was referencing earlier, navigating grief from a sober perspective, I was then invited to explore all the grief I'd not explored, all the times I'd used beer or something to not feel, or like relationship or sex or intimacy or, and I think now, and where my question is from this is, do you think that the world today is better at grief or worse, given technological advances and all these types of things? Because you see the preparation in the rooms you're in.
Yeah. So when you say better or worse, I would say yes. You know,
great. I like
because of technological advancement. You know how it is with any kind of gift or anything cultural that we're given that pushes us forward, there's, you know, blessings and curses in it, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm looking up right now something for you that I saw kind of recently.
Yeah.
And it's a thing called Christian grief coaching. And it's this kind of new trend that has taken off. And it says, the tagline is, and by the way, if anyone has gotten something out of Christian grief coaching, I don't want to dunk on you. I'm glad that it's helped, but I just have to read this. Grief stops, joy starts. Reduce suffering 5 to 8 years, often down to months. Control your emotions, they're deceitful. Build a personal firewall to protect your thought life. Overcome grief more quickly than with a therapist.
Wow.
Put grief down and learn to live again. So are we getting better at grief? I think with more stuff out there, yes. More stuff out there, no.
Right. Well, depending what the algorithm delivers us, I suppose. I hope it delivers J.S. Park.
Oh, well, you know, and I'm not perfect at either. I'm still learning and my hands are still open. I think, you know, I'm glad that
the message, you know, is that you're saying that in my opinion.
Well, I hope that I would never devise a program that says reduce your suffering down to months.
Live, put your grief away and truly live, as opposed to the grief is the living, the walking with it is.
Yeah. You know, here's a firewall to protect your thoughts. You know,
computer reference to protect your thoughts.
Yeah. As if grief is like a virus or something, right? So I, you know, grief literacy, I think, is getting better. I think one of the reasons why I feel like I was surprised that my platform got numbers the way that it did. You know, I don't think I'm some huge platform, but there were people, you know, leaving lots of comments and engaging with it. I had high engagement and still do with quite a few posts. And I think it's because people are feeling more willing to have the conversation about mortality, about loss, about what hurts, about trauma. And that shows me that even if we don't have all the tools or the equipment, even if all the mental and emotional furniture is not in place, people are willing to have the conversation. They want to enter the room. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing that willingness to learn the language, to be fluent in it. And with that, there's going to be good stuff out there and bad stuff out there. You know, people offering infomercials and their own models and things, you know, to sell. And at the same time, there are going to be people who do the work and are in the arena and want to pass along, hey, here's this fluid, flexible way that we can do grief together and what I've learned, you know, from being in the fray. And I'm so glad for that. You know, it's just like the conversation with mental health, which is only like a degree or two. In fact, there's overlap with mental health and grief. Mm-hmm. But with mental health, you know, the last couple decades, there's been more and more talk about more openness and more willingness to talk about it, less stigma. Does stigma still exist? Absolutely. You know, when I tell people that I take medication for mental health, some people are like, you're brave for admitting that. Some people are like, you know, I can't believe you're one of those people, you know? So that's still there. And I've noticed too, with like, even with Disney movies, there's more discussion of intergenerational trauma, you know, mm-hmm. and how parents affect children and how adult children can break the cycle. You know, we're seeing that in movies. We're seeing that especially in horror movies, more social and commentary, you know, more of those kind of things. I feel like the more discussion about it, the better. And I guess you don't have to take the good with the bad, but there is going to be bad there. And so I'm kind of welcoming right now this almost fire hose or buckshot of the grief discussion. Because there is a door, I feel like, that's been open in the last 5 to 10 years where grief is being more openly talked about. And at the same time, I would caution to have wisdom and discernment, to have safe people to kind of navigate through those spaces. Because if you run across a site that says, you know, grief stops, joy starts, suffering down to months, that to me, it maybe it's helped somebody, but that to me is dangerous, and there shouldn't be guarantees like that in there.
Yeah, I think that's beautifully expressed. And I'm curious, for the people listening, what could they hope to find, or what would be possible through exploring your book, reading your book, consuming your work?
Yeah, you know, I hope at least three things. They could name what they're going through, then validate the things that they name, and then be able to find some kind of ritual or way of honoring the loss, at least those three things. And even if it's just one of those things, that's perfect. And you know, the book isn't like a didactic, instructional, pragmatic handbook. There, you know, there are stories in it and there's memoir stuff in it. There are some kind of practical handholds, but mostly it's just the telling of, I do more showing than telling. But through that, maybe someone can read the book and say, I'm not alone in this, and I'm my thoughts are not wrong. My feelings are not wrong, and they're validated. And here are some ways now that I can intentionally and consciously choose to grieve. And so if those would be the takeaways, I think that's something as a chaplain that I've tried to facilitate and help my patients and their families do, and our staff do as well. And so if the reader can do even half of one of those things, then I will have considered that is success, at least for what I've wrote.
Incredible. And I mean, the way that you write, also the way that you speak, but the way that you write is so relatable, and through the story and narrative, that people are learning these, seeing their own stories within the stories, and also how to walk through it. It's such a gift. And, you know, we were talking, I was asking previously, like, are we better or worse? And you said, yes. I love that, because I do think that there is a conversation that's happening about grief that has maybe not been happening on such a mass scale before. And there is a desire to be able to confront what is inevitable. And we might as well build the skills and the understanding, but not just that it's inevitable we're going to confront it, but we have had it in our lives and we maybe have not actually named it and walked through it and built some ritual or strategy. So thanks so much for writing the book. And thank you for, I know you said, you know, with a tense signature on the contract, said yes to what you're willing to hold for now.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just appreciate that there's such honesty in the way that you express.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mark, for making such an open space to talk about it. I feel like these conversations are needed. They're important. And, you know, I don't want to make light of this either or make it say something else it doesn't mean, but having two men talking about grief, emotions, you know, vulnerability, trauma, that's a big thing. You know, I'm not on a whole lot of platforms like that. And I don't want that to say something else, you know, that it doesn't mean. But yeah. For me, that is a win. That is a big victory and it is a big deal. So I say that to commend you and applaud you in opening the space for that and being, yeah, willing to discuss it.
Man, thank you so much. And thanks for sharing this space. And for people listening, where can they find more of you? We definitely want to get that out.
I'm JS Park on all the things, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Instagram is where I engage the most, and I do check most of my messages and respond. So I am happy to engage there. And the book is at aslongasyouneedbook.com.
We only scratched the very, very, very surface of what is within the book. And I look forward to all of you consuming it. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark, and all listening. Much gentleness, peace, and love. Thank you.